Hello, Bonesaw friends. This is Evan Pardue of Underhill Bonesaw, and welcome to episode 92 of Little Things for Bonesaw People. It's approaching the end of the summer here. We're starting to finally cool off, and everything's kind of, you know, it's all right. It's been pretty wet. Got a little bit of fall color on some plants because they're confused, but otherwise it's doing okay. But this time I am joined by one of my co-hosts, Carmen Lesko-Bienski. How's it going?
Pretty good. How are you?
I'm doing okay. How's Portland weather?
It's going to be really hot. We're going to have like 4 days above 90. I am not excited.
Yeah.
At all.
Yeah. It needs to taper off. We need a break here.
No, thank you.
Yeah. And then,
then we fall back down into like normal, but this week is going to be the worst.
So. Yeah. Sorry to hear that. And of course, today we have a very special guest with us today, Californian bonsai artist Julian Tsai. How's it going, Julian?
Pretty good. Yeah, I'm doing well.
Yep. And you're in what part of California?
I'm in Los Angeles County. The city's Arcadia, so it's a bit outside of actually the city of Los Angeles.
Awesome. And how's the weather faring for you?
It's been pretty warm on average this year. Less heat waves, but it's been consistently sitting like a few degrees warmer than usual. But I think we're going to have our last heat wave probably this coming week. It's going to be pretty hot, though, saying like 108 or something.
Jeez. Oh, my gosh.
Yep. Yeah. Well, as always, we make sure to talk about the weather just a little bit before we get to our main topic. But yeah, before we go any further, our podcast is sponsored by our amazing patrons over at patreon.com/littlethingsforbonsai people. Head on over there, become a bonsai best bud, and hang out in the Discord with these amazing people. We have so many patrons now that I usually just name them off at the end of the episodes, but I only have one featured bonsai best bud that I shout out at the beginning of each episode, and that's going to be Varies Bonesai this week. Thank you so much, Varies Bonesai, for sponsoring at the $5 level and supporting the little things and keeping us going. Every little bit counts, of course, and bonsai is not an easy career, so we really appreciate you guys' support. And then, of course, we always shout out the specimen best buds, Unryuin out of Australia, and Bill's Bayou, Bill Butler out of my neck of the woods in Louisiana. Thank you so much for supporting the show at the $30 level. And of course, our overall sponsor, our show sponsor, Joshua Roth Tools. Thank you, John, with Joshua Roth Tools for sponsoring our show and providing us with all the funds we need to do awesome things like provide you guys with merch, be able to attend events and give out Joshua Roth Tools to our people who participate in classical design awards that Joshua Roth normally does. It's really awesome. And then, of course, we can't go any much further without mentioning our editor, Matt O'Donnell. He makes us sound smart. He cleans up our audio and makes us enjoyable to listen to. Head over to mattodonnell.com and contact Matt to start your own podcast show with him or an audio engineering project. He is a set bassist living in Nashville, Tennessee. He's an all-around awesome guy, and I say it every single time. Also, check out Matt's show, his own podcast show called Matt O'Donnell Wants to Know. So, yeah. How is it going, everyone? I just want to just open it up to the floor. How y'all feeling today?
Pretty good. Just a normal day. I just drove back from Sacramento yesterday, and then today's kind of just like some downtime, and which is nice to have some of these free days. Don't have to do too much.
Mm-hmm. And like we've talked in the past, you deal with a lot of clientele in your part of the county out there, right?
Yeah. So, currently my work base is still right mainly West Coast, like California. And then I have right locally in like LA County, San Diego County, where I do a lot of my work. But I was thinking the other day in terms of kind of, what my work distribution is. And I don't have like a single large like location demographic where say like more than 50% of my work is in one spot. And so I've been kind of everywhere, but probably by like a larger percentile, it's still Los Angeles. And so I work everywhere around here.
Mm-hmm.
That's really cool. Do you have your own collection or are you mostly just doing client work?
I do have my own collection, probably like 50 to 60 trees is my guess. And I would say like maybe 10 can be pretty good, like exhibitable. And then the rest are like various stage of projects. So just growing stuff.
Yeah, sure, fun, huh? Yeah. And what's, so in California, in the Los Angeles County, what is the range of preferred species look like for you guys? What are y'all working with?
So in terms of species diversities, and let's say like, so if I say within Los Angeles County, I mean, we actually do have some range of microclimates. And so the species diversities is quite wide. Our main limitation is just we don't have a proper like winter dormancy. I mean, if you were like in the foothills or entering the mountains a bit, yes. But most people, you know, at our lowest temperatures, you know, we might hit mid 40s, low 40s. It's just enough, say, for like Japanese maples and some temperate deciduous. But conifers that require winter temperatures, like no way, they'll just slowly decline. So pretty much we can grow anything that does not require a winter dormancy. But then there also are some tropical species that are probably not so happy under 50 degrees. Stuff like buttonwoods is like a little finicky here. Some people have them, but if we do hit the low 40s, they seem kind of pissed off. Outside of like those kind of cases, in a sense, is pretty good. We can grow most species, no problem.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And so we got a good coverage on clientele work, and I had to actually kind of refresh myself on Los Angeles, like as far as it's located, because you were starting to say like dormancy period and was kind of an issue. And I was like, oh, wait, that is quite south of California. I didn't realize all
we're,
that. Yeah,
we're definitely right. Southern California proper. I mean, right. There's like a lot of microclimates in SoCal, which is kind of in this mid upper range temperature bracket. Kind of everything levels out in terms of the bottom ranges, right? Won't get colder than a certain point. But yeah.
Cool. Just, you know, for our listeners out there, this podcast is aimed towards beginners and kind of so people can dip their toes in the world of bonsai. So a lot of people might not be really familiar with who you are or where you came from. I know that you have been showing up a lot in a lot of places recently, but for those who are not 100% sure, give us a little bit of background on yourself before we go too far into the bonsai side.
Sure. So, you know, I've probably been in bonsai now for, it's like about 11 years. And so I started right when I got out of high school. And then so you can basically guess my age from that. I'm still pretty young.
Man, we need more young people.
And so, yeah, it's been like 11 years since then. And you know, when I got into bonsai, it was just very immediately like an obsession. It like clicked in my mind like that very day. I kind of actively thought of it. And I was like, oh, this is like really cool. Like, I have to do this. And so when I was in college, it was kind of a big obsession hobby. I think all my free time, I would just do something bonsai related. So I would watch whatever YouTube videos, like every single free article I can find online. Is pretty obsessive, right? It's kind of, just like all I did for a while. I just really wanted to find information. And so that kind of went on for like, you know, 3-4 years or so. And yeah, like Southern California has a lot of bonsai history. So, you know, some professionals, semi-professionals, and then there's like a kind of generation of practitioners from the like John Naka era. Yeah. And so in a sense, there's exposure where I can at least directly or indirectly know somebody doing bonsai professionally. And so I knew of like apprenticeships, right? And people pursuing that as a professional route. And so I was pretty fortunate. I didn't even know if going to Japan was an option. I was thinking like, oh, I have to meet somebody in the US, work with them, and they would refer me to go to a nursery. And then I think it was 2017, I had like a internship during college, and I was living in working in Lamont, Illinois. It's like a a suburb right outside of Chicago. And then really close, I was working at the lab. There's a national lab there. And within like, whatever, 5 miles of the lab was Jeff Schultz Nursery, right? The Hidden Gardens. And so, you know, at the time I was like, I just try to find bonsai wherever I went. So I reached out to him. I said, like, hey, I'm going to be living and working in your area for this whole summer. And then can I just come to your nursery? And right. And people know Jeff. He's very like generous, very nice, gracious, pretty like big supporter in the bonsai community, especially the Midwest area. And so he welcomed me right very easily. And so it was kind of, it was funny. I was there to work and do like research, right? My background is originally in like material science, but I think every day after my program, whatever, I just go to the nursery and I was like, oh, I rather do bonsai. I don't want to stay in the lab. And so I did that over the summer. And at that time when I was there, I met Owen Reich, right? Who was a professional, I think based out of like Tennessee.
Yeah,
I'm not exactly
Tennessee
sure
now.
Where in Tennessee, I can't remember. But he had, right, it's like well over 10 years ago now, had apprenticed at a Fujikawa Kokaen. And so they needed apprentices at that time. And so I kind of worked with Jeff and kind of a little bit with Owen and helped out at the Midwest Bonsai Show. And then so he said, if you're serious, I'll refer you to my boss and then we can kind of just see how things go. And so that ended up working out. I went to go visit the nursery in person and go talk to them. And then the year after I graduated, right, I went there to apprentice. I only ended up staying like just about 2 years. So from 2018 and then a pandemic hit 2020. That was kind of like coincidental. I was initially like timing to leave right when the pandemic started, but just have everything happened at the same time. So that was a pretty chaotic period. So I was like 2 years there apprenticing in Japan, which, you know, like I think at the moment it was like a hard experience. And then there's all sorts of like drama or problems that can happen. And so I think at the moment I was like, you know, sometimes have conflicts or get upset about stuff. But then when you look in hindsight, like I really definitely appreciate that experience. And kind of later down the line, I reached out to my boss, kind of made sure I was on good terms with him. So that was overall, I think, important just to have that exposure. I guess just for like a newer or beginner bonsai people, and then you thinking about learning or even entertaining the idea of like what's an apprenticeship. I would say the biggest value in terms of learning, say especially in Japan, it's just you can see trees which are old as bonsai. And so you start to kind of think, what does that mean for a tree to become old as bonsai? And it's not just the physical age. Has it kind of accrued that history of work over that time span? So successfully cultivated and developed over however many years. Of course, there are old trees in the U.S., but a much smaller percentage. And there are trees which are old, but say not continuously cultivated, say over 50 years. Maybe had some years it was developed, some years it was set back, some years it was just maintained. So that same accruation of age is not quite the same. So in that sense, that was a really great experience for me, because before that, I was completely self-taught hobbyist, right? And not really had any teacher or affiliated with any organization. I was just like dabbling, basically, find stuff to learn and try out, things I was excited about. And so that was 2 years then, and then the pandemic hit. And at that time, I was like, at first, I was not even certain about doing bonsai professionally. I was like, oh, because this can't, I mean, that was my original intention. But I think a few years in it, I was like pretty skeptical of myself and kind of not sure if I can make it work or not. And then on top of that, I was like COVID pandemic, right? Like worst timing. So I was not going to be able to travel or say do the kind of traditional traveling / club circuit, like new professionals promote themselves and maybe one aspect. So that was kind of postponed for a few years. I fell back on my college education, kind of worked. I was working out in San Diego. And then I think like about 2 years ago, you know, I was already planning. Well, I kind of skipped it. And then so over that like period during COVID, you know, I still, of course, liked bonsai and wanted to learn in some serious capacity, because I very quickly understood, like after my 2 years at Kokaan, like even though I can say relative to myself, my skill had increased a lot. And you could say it was at least like semi-professional, maybe professional level work. Like I knew the skill cap was super high, seeing like truly very good work and just like what it encompasses. And I was like, oh crap, like his 2 years was like nothing. Like I like if I really want, and it was kind of for myself, like for me to feel, you know, I was really pursuing this as high of a level as possible. It's like I have to find something to continue to learn. So I was very lucky and fortunate, actually, over the pandemic period. I found two very skilled professionals who, you know, in some sense, really helped me out, kind of like mentored me, and I was able to see their work and whatnot. One was a Los Angeles-based professional, John Wong, and he apprenticed at a Mont Sayan nursery, which is actually the same nursery family as Kokaan. And I mean, it's quite a while ago. I can't remember when he apprenticed, but maybe it's like 20 years ago now, or 15 years ago, 15 to 20 years ago is probably my guess. And so, you know, a lot of people don't know John, and because like he really is not involved with any clubs, doesn't care to travel. But when he was an active professional, basically he only worked with a small number of like high-end clients in like Los Angeles, Southern California area. And definitely he was objectively the best skill-wise professional in like Southern California, at least the bottom half of California, right? It was like nothing close, right? In terms of like a competent professional who really knew what they're doing. And he lived like 5 minutes from me. So I was like super lucky, right? And so, you know, I was able to work with him a bit and see his trees, and very grateful for that. And then the other professional I was working with, and still actually I just came back from his place yesterday, is Peter T, right? And he's based out in Sacramento. And, you know, I met him for the first time actually in Japan. I was vending and working at the Kokufu show. I think it was the 2019 Kokufu. And I don't remember which show number that was, but I saw Peter there, and he was showing around some clients, had some kind of small tour group. And of course, like many bonsai practitioners knew him from his bonsai blog back when the blogs were more prolific, right? They seem kind of like fizzling out a bit, you know? Right. I'm pretty sure you can look up like the blog statistics, but at that time it was probably the most popular bonsai blog. And so that's how a lot of people knew him, because it just had very clean, concise information. The work was very precise, technically at a high level. And it raises all this free information online. And so that was great. And so I really liked his work and his blog. And so I met him in person in Japan, but just kind of barely talked to him. And when I came back in COVID, and you know, I had that self-realization, if I want to continue to learn and be proficient, I need to find people to learn from. I initially emailed Peter, and then I think I told him something along the lines that, like, hey, can I just join your workshop or study group or whatever? And just so I can just kind of see what he's doing and get exposure. And you know, Peter has really helped me a lot. He's very gracious in that at that time, you know, he told me, he's like, you know, you're trying to do this professionally, right? You're not just like some random workshop attendee. He said, you should just come over and just help me out, and I can like, you can learn. And so he's really helped me like quite a lot over the last like three, four years now. And so that kind of like gave me a lot of opportunities to learn, kind of see, also kind of in a sense, be more well-rounded. I see from, you know, different professionals, you know, what their branch technique is, their kind of stylistic habits, and kind of the motivators behind that. And so I was very fortunate over all that time I could find, you know, great, you know, people to work with. And so kind of after a few years of that, and I was deciding to leave my job in San Diego, it kind of escalated in my mind, because I was thinking for a long time, like, oh, can I do bonsai professionally? That I would give myself basically a trial year where my only income would be off bonsai. And I would gauge the potential off that, like if I could get enough clients, how stable my income is. And I told myself, based off this trial year, I would make a decision. Either I'm going to stick with it and just commit to being a bonsai professional, or maybe I just decide, like, oh, I can't make it, and I just have to do it as a hobby or a semi-professional. But fortunately, you know, things worked out. It's kind of been growing since. And so since the last 2 years, then I've just been doing, yeah, only bonsai work, which is, you know, a lot of travel and... But just having good, like, long-term clients, that's pretty important. So definitely a lot to be grateful for and pretty blessed.
Nathan?
That's a great story. It's very relatable in a couple of ways I've found for myself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm coming to the, quote, end of my apprenticeship, but it still feels like I could stay another 5 years and still be learning. So just like you were saying, like, it doesn't really end when you're done. Like, right, there's still so much more to keep doing. Mm-hmm. The trial year, I felt like before I came out to study with Michael, before I had met Michael, actually, I was, mm-hmm, you know, debating what I was doing with my career, and was like, okay, I'm going to give myself a year of trying this. And
yeah,
you know, then it's all over. So, well, it sounds like you've, I mean, it's great that you've been able to support yourself just with bonsai work and, you know, build that kind of clientele that you can do that. So that's awesome.
And so as far as maintaining your own trees, Julian, do you hand water them all and care for them like you typically would with a professional bonsai garden? Do you have the time for that kind of thing?
Pretty much. But you know, when I'm gone, I'm like traveling a lot. It's my parents actually water my trees for me.
Nice.
So that's like pretty lucky. And I mean, they're like plant people, and so they kind of know.
Mm-hmm.
And otherwise that's a tough part. And kind of for the number of trees I have, 56 is definitely the max number I can handle right now. And because the more you try to load your work schedule, especially say if I'm not working like locally, well, let's just say it means I don't sleep in my bed that night, right? I'm gone, mm-hmm, somewhere, then, you know, I'm not home to water the trees, you know, catch up on some maintenance. And so I really have to manage my time well, where I have like, oh, I have a gap now, I need to get everything done, like, at this moment, just no, I can't wait. And so I've found like I'm on top of it, but it's definitely like, if I had more trees, it would be hard for like a traveling work schedule. And so definitely there's like some, you know, concessions and trade-offs, and it also depends on the kind of trees you have, because, you know, some stuff I'm just growing, and say I'm developing like my early stage branching, or I'm trying to grow sacrifices, you know, as long as you know what you're doing and planning for the work, maybe the volume of work is not that much, right? You just try to work precisely, just do absolutely what must be done. And you can get away with that, and trees still okay. Say, for example, if you had a lot of pines, right, like black pines and pines which are entering kind of branch building and refinement, then your work scaling gets like exponential the more you build the tree, because you're plucking more buds, more shoots. And so if I had a lot of that kind of tree, and then it's kind of like, oh, crap, I don't know if I can do this. And so it's kind of just finding like a balance of what's, I like having a diversified collection. It's just more fun. And so it's a little bit of every type of species, and just figuring out what I can actually, you know, manage and take on and be on top of. Because ultimately I still want to develop the trees. It's not just water and let them randomly grow. And so I still try to keep on top of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I tell people this a lot, too, because they're always like, oh, this seems like so much work. And I'm like, well, it depends how many trees you have and what you need to do to them and when. If you have a really diverse collection, you're always doing something. If you just have black pine, there's like a couple windows where you're really, really busy. And the rest of the time, it's like, eh, just watering. It's totally dependent on all of that. But it's definitely more fun having a bunch of variety, I think. I like to be busy. So
We speak about on our show a lot about things like lifestyle as far as what is manageable for somebody who's in bonsai. And so it's interesting to hear like another bonsai professional's take on like what is this possible, especially with a busy work schedule. How many trees in 50, 60 trees is for me would be pushing it because now that we have our child here, Rory, and me and my wife are working with him way more than I get to work with my trees. I'm thankful for the type of trees that I have. But yeah, it's, you know, I like we talked about this in an earlier episode where the type of trees that I have are mostly deciduous. So that type of work is a lot easier to go through and maintain. And not so much on like, you know, time windows. It's just if the trees are growing, it's time to work, which is almost all the time. But yeah. But as far as your collection goes, is there a favorite, like a preferred species of your own? Do you favor a species?
Yeah, I thought about this because, of course, people ask that question like all the time. And it's like really hard for me to say, like, because definitely the way I look at like a species is good for a reason, right? And so maybe it's not like directly comparable, like the reason why a pine is good versus a juniper is good. Yeah. And so I end up growing them because I like it for that specific reason. And so in that sense, it's, at least for right now, it's currently hard for me to have a well-defined, like oh, like this is like my favorite. I mean, of course, I like all the main species like junipers, maples, pines, or our domestic variations. I kind of look at it as just a general broad classification of a tree, because in any temperate climate you will have like a variation of one of those species, and so that's kind of like the ubiquitous core of bonsai, and then it can expand of course more and more and more. So I don't have a specific answer for that.
It's like we say sometimes on the show, our favorite tree is the one we just worked on.
Because
you just spent several hours on it doing whatever you need to. So,
or then it becomes your least favorite tree. First hour you're working on it, it's your favorite. And then the last hour you're like, oh my God, am I done yet?
Hey guys, it's Evan with Underhill Bonsai and, of course, The Little Things. And we want to just let you know that we have a scholarship fund for bonsai education that's going to be supplied by The Little Things ourselves, as well as Joshua Roth Tools. John said he is excited about the scholarship and that he wanted to do his own contribution as well. John will be contributing $200 worth of Joshua Roth tools to the scholarship fund as well. So in addition to being able to go to a local bonsai establishment, either it be a bonsai nursery or a bonsai professional, and seek training or classes through them, Joshua Roth will also send you a nice beginner set of $200 worth of tools to fit your needs for your bonsai goals and dreams.
This podcast is supported by Bonsai Bar, the beginner bonsai workshop popping up in breweries all across the Northeast. Bonsai Bar is 2 hours of tiny tree goodness disguised as a night out with friends. Come grab drinks, create a new tree, and watch as your friends and family get the bug for bonsai. Bonsai Bar is always looking for teachers and assistants, and you listen to this podcast, so you're probably already qualified. Bring your knowledge out to the bar. Apply today. Find event tickets, contact info, and more at bonsaibar.com.
Hey guys, it's Evan with Underhill Bonsai, and I just want to tell you guys about Save Bonsai. It's going to be happening from March 28th to the 30th, 2025. We're going to be everything Louisiana for a full weekend, so we're going to include a crawfish boil, homemade gumbo, and other food trucks and vendors that are very special, I guess you can say, the southern culture of Louisiana. And also, the show will include a bonsai show with its own special awards, including Best in Show, Best Shohin, Best Traditional Design, People's Choice Award, and also a tongue-in-cheek Best Bald Cypress Bonsai Award. Guest artists and visiting artists will include Julian Tsai, Sylvia Smith, Mike Lane, Carmen Lesko-Bienski, Dawn Ketting, Randy Bennett, and Guy Guidry. Each artist will be presenting demonstrations and giving workshops throughout the weekend. You can go over to underhillbonsaistore.com and go under our Save Bonsai Workshops tab, and you can sign up for just regular attendance. It's going to be $25 just to get into the exhibit tent, and then all the workshops will be spaced out, and they will all have individual pricing. We hope to see you guys there. As far as your time in Japan, that was something I wanted to kind of revisit a little bit more.
Sure,
because
we
don't get to talk to a lot of people who have trained in Japan. We've had a handful, probably two or three people so far.
Yeah.
But you were there for the 2 years, and you said it was difficult because this was at the peak of COVID, basically.
Like this, right before. Yeah.
Right before. Okay, so yeah, because you had stepped. So everything was actually pretty good, pretty lively. You were getting to do, obviously, you got to do Kokufu. So, and when you were there, I mean, I just have to ask, like, as far as your apprenticeship, what were your daily responsibilities? Was it more difficult than you had assumed, or was it overly romanticized? Because a lot of people have different expectations, so, like, a lot of different experiences.
I felt my... In some sense, my expectations were pretty good going into the apprenticeship, and because by then I knew a lot of people who have done that, and so I had a basic idea of what it would entail, at least as far as the culture and the work. And so in some sense, I was very prepared for that and had no issues kind of adjusting to the workload and culture. And I at least from the time I found I was going to go to Japan, I really prepared language wise as well. And so that in that aspect, I was okay. I didn't have some super exciting, romanticized view of just working on trees every day and having fun. Of course, sometimes there's that, but there's also just some realities of work and things you need to do and kind of learn that process. I would say in terms of, expectations, and this is probably maybe a culture difference, right? Coming from the U.S. I mean, I'm not Japanese, but then my family background is some Taiwanese and Chinese. But maybe there's not a lot, but some base cultural similarities. And so in that sense, maybe it was easy for me to adjust. I was losing my train of thought. Oh, okay.
That's all right.
I'll talk about later what I did find difficult. But kind of speaking generally, I would say a common, issue that people will have is that, when you're an apprentice and kind of the mindset perspective you typically will have or should have to your boss, it's kind of like, I am grateful for this opportunity to learn, and whatever you bestow upon me, right, it's just what I can get. So you're entitled to nothing, basically, right? And that's kind of very harsh mentality, where, right, people have the romanticized and stereotype stories first you only sweep, and then you only clean, and then maybe you water, and then later, it's not literally that per se. But the kind of idea is that you have a repertoire and you build trust, right, with your oyakata, your boss, And over time, they make some concessions to you in terms of like, okay, I'll let you do a little bit more. But your position is always from like, I am grateful, right? And then you're going to have, I think, a lot easier time with that mindset. But then if you go in like super headstrong and like, or even worse, you approach, and this has happened, right? I won't say like who, but this has definitely happened in the past where people go in from the get-go and they're just kind of expecting things or you know, sometimes people will straight up say like, oh, I'm good already, or I know how to do this. That's like the worst thing you can say, right? Entering an apprenticeship. They're just going to be like, then why are you here? And so that's kind of like a baseline expectation of, in terms of, I would say, like conditioning your mindset. So you're going to have an easier time and you're going to build that dynamic and trust better, right? And that's, I think, pretty important long term. You know, for me personally, kind of what ended up being like very difficult was more kind of, I would say, like apprentice dynamics. I think at that time when I came there, this was like already after Bjorn had returned to the US. I'm like a whole generation apprentice after. And then I had my senpai there at the time, Naoki Maoka, who's very skilled, a really nice guy, helped me a lot. And we had like a probably just under a year overlap. He wasn't an apprentice anymore, right? He's just working at the nursery. And then for a brief time, I was the only apprentice there, actually. And then later we had another guy from the US, right? Kaya, and a guy from Canada, Michael, and they came later. And yeah, I won't go into like so much details because it's too like personal or specific, right, to that nursery. Yeah. So these are things I can't really talk about. But I think I didn't like anticipate like kind of inner apprentice dynamics, and then also like very quickly becoming then the only apprentice or then senior apprentice. There's this kind of like senpai kohai dynamic as well. And then just the nursery naturally undergoing changes, right? Like I think in like Bjorn's generation, my boss's father was still alive and then he had passed later on, and just the nursery just changing over time in Japan and just some dynamics like that. And that basically I guess in some sense, I had a romanticized expectation where, you know, I was prepared to work hard, but I'm like here to learn bonsai at its quote unquote best, right? And I did learn a lot of good things, right? I'm not trying to discredit that. But I think there is a lot of things that were also outside of my expectations where it could be in terms of the work or the way the business is run. And then say for the type of nursery like Kokaen and many nurseries in Japan is kind of similar to this. They're kind of like broker nurseries where, you know, you do have a percentage of clients, you're working with a domestic client base like in Japan, but then a lot of the trees could be just with the intent to sell, right? And sell to brokers to China and Europe. So in some sense, you get a lot of throughput, you get to work on a lot of trees, but you're just like turning stuff out with intention to sell it, which can be good or bad, right? And so there's like some, I guess, like changes and some kind of like weird inter-apprentice dynamics for a time that just a lot of things happened simultaneously that was just like really stressful and kind of really bad for me, like mentally at that time. And so I was just like really kind of sort of depressed and unsure of just like, oh crap, like what am I doing here? I think in hindsight, right, and it's always right, it's nice to say in hindsight, but it's never real. You know, if I stayed probably for like another year and a half, that probably would have been like perfect for my personal situation. And so things didn't work quite to plan, right? And it was kind of, this was not good in the sense, you know, I would say, and I'm sure my boss would attest to this also, like if people asked him, that I was a very good apprentice to him, never caused him issues, super responsible. I helped out all the other apprentices, did translating, everything. So I don't think he has anything he could complain about me. But when I decided to leave, it was like spontaneous because it's just, I kind of just decided like through myself or talking to like my senpai at the time, Naoki Maoka, and then just kind of seeing the changes that was going on in the nursery. I was like uncertain if the long-term trajectory was either good for me or stable. And so when I decided to leave, it was just like very, like my, I mean, my boss, he probably felt like, oh, something's going on. And so I kind of just threw it upon him all of a sudden. And, you know, I had something I did, which was not good. And it's just kind of my immaturity at that time was like, I felt like I really had to defend myself, my reasons for leaving, because I felt so invested in this that like me leaving, it's just like not only betraying myself, but then it's like I was worried because, of course, doing this professionally, you know, people will judge you like, oh, you're only there like 2 years. Why didn't you stay longer? Yeah. And I was like, I have to validate and prove my reasons that it was a legitimate reason. And I was just not like whatever, like half-assed and giving up. And so I remember at that time, I was also kind of like mad with my boss in Japan. And, you know, and I just straight up, I just, oh, the very day I left, you know, I just told him all the things that was bad about the nursery. So it was like, thinking back, it was such a crazy, intense time. And you know, and the funny thing is like, you know, the moment, you know, I think all the things I said was true and it was very well justified. And like, I can't even remember what they were anymore. But in the moment, right, I was super upset. And then, so kind of what happened, I was talking about John Wong, right, professional in LA. And he studied at Mont Saint-Anne. And so my boss, he apprenticed at Mont Saint-Anne, right? I think he was probably like Saburo Kato's, one of his last apprentices. And so it's like in the same nursery family. And so kind of like I had talked to John, he knew like what kind of shit was going down and I was apprenticing. And he didn't really follow through with this, but it was a good thing he said this anyways. But he was kind of sort of retiring from Bonsai, right? And this was like a loose promise, but he said like I'll give you my best clients in LA under the condition you're on good terms with your boss. And I was like, oh crap, like I don't know, like how this is gonna work. Like I kind of left abruptly and so I thought about it for like 6 months probably. I was like, oh, what should I do? And you know, I think it's funny, I was talking to two of my other apprentice or bonsai professional friends, Seth Nelson and then Michael Matique, the Canadian apprentice, and I have great relations with both of them. And I was telling them, I was like, yeah, I'm like thinking about doing this. And right, because Michael is still Kokaian, I was asking Michael, I was like, hey, like, does Oyakata ever talk about me? like, what does he say about me? And you know, they both gave me some pretty good advice. And then the interesting thing Michael is telling me, he's like, he says he doesn't know if he's like, he's actually mad at me. He says maybe he's just upset that it just kind of didn't work out. And yes. I was like, oh, okay, at least maybe that's not good. Because I was kind of afraid I would go back and just be like, this guy's really mad. And so anyways, I thought about what John said. And then, you know, this is still COVID and pandemic. And then like Japan's borders opened back up October 2022. And then I was like, all right, like I have to do this, right? And so I went like, I think early November, just like barely right after it opened up. And I think I prepared, like I like practiced my Japanese and I prepared this whole like a formal apology that I was like, okay, I'm gonna do this. And it was like, my Japanese was like, okay, like just moderately proficient contextually, but it's like still like very nervous. And then there's like some kind of format. If I wanted to do it right, you know, there's a kind of formality, how you talk to people, like say in the US, when you talk to like your boss, right, in a corporate setting. Of course, there's still some professionalism and respect, but there's still some idea where you can just talk to them, right, using your normal interaction. But there's kind of like a culturally ingrained social hierarchy that in Japan, depending their relation to you, right, like family, workplace, senior or younger, right, there's a dynamic that's not just implied. It's like your verbalization, the vocabulary, the words, everything changes. And so it was kind of like a lot. I had to get myself in that mindset and prepare. And I was kind of like afraid that I was going to get like so nervous. And I was talking to him, I was going to like like mess up and lose my train of thought and then just give like a half-assed condensed version of what I wanted to say. So I was like really stressed about that. And so I flew there, and literally that's the first thing I did. I landed and I just went straight to the nursery. And you're right, I talked to him. There's like no hiccups. And then surprisingly, it was fine, right? He seemed to be like very understanding and at least gracious about that. And I think it's because like my reasons for like leaving, it's not like I like caused some crazy problem, right? Mm-hmm. There is no kind of bad issue like that. And so he seemed pretty happy that I came over, and that was like a huge like burden off my shoulders, because I was worrying like for 3 years. I was like, oh, like what have I done? Like,
yeah.
And so that was really great, actually, that I did that, and things were kind of patched up in that sense. And then so that was kind of like my experience there. And so like for me, like in the work sense, it is totally fine. But I think there's the main issue that I look back in terms of like my own maturity. I think in any like given situation, it's great if things work out with a perfect plan trajectory. But it's like sometimes, right, shit happens, things you don't account for. Maybe it's out of your control, right? Not even your fault. And that, I think my problem at the time is I couldn't accept unexpected things changing, right? And I was just like not handling it well. And so that was like a very harsh learning experience for me in that sense. Right? I had to figure out all the mistakes the hard way. So I feel very lucky that in that whole like interim period over the pandemic, I was kind of doing bonsai semi-professionally and learning. You know, I felt if I didn't have the right kind of people to talk to and mentors, you know, I don't know if I would have done all that, right? And because, you know, sometimes people is like, maybe they don't care or they don't have good intentions for you necessarily. And so kind of very lucky, even like I always talk about John Wong, or people who met him in person will know he has a crazy personality, sometimes hard to be around. And even despite like his kind of like issues in that sense, you know, that was like the best thing he did for me, right? To kind of encourage me to do that. And so very, very fortunate in that sense that I can basically recover over that time period, progress my skills more, and then re-enter that professional trajectory. Because in my mind, I was like, oh, I have this perfect 5-year apprentice plan, and then the work is just going to be all lined up for me. And it's just, right, that's, of course, it's great, right? You can do that. But you know, sometimes things is not so clean, perfect pass. So I had to learn the hard way to just kind of accommodate for that. And definitely you have to really want to do bonsai.
Oh, yeah.
Deal with all this like shit, because there's a bunch of shit can go down. And so for me, I found, right, I just really liked bonsai and how to do it. And so it worked out. Mm-hmm. That's good.
I'm so glad that you were able to like mend that, that gap between you and your boss, because that I've heard, you know, you hear some stories about apprentices leaving, or, you know, it sounds like some of the biggest challenges over there really are the social interactions and the interpersonal stuff between everybody there. And it's frustrating in one sense, because you're like, we all just want to do bonsai. Can't we all just get along? I'm so glad that you could mend that problem, because, and, you know, I imagine a lot of the Oyakatas can be pretty understanding if you give them the chance to be. But I mean, I am terrified of authority, so I would have had the hardest time. You're so brave to go back and do that. I would have been terrified. So
I was definitely like super scared. And it was just like, I remember like when I went on that trip, I was like, and of course it was kind of like a respect and kind of just like consensus, like that should be the first thing I do when I get there. Mm-hmm. Not like oh, you came to Japan, you do all this other stuff, and then it was an afterthought.
Right.
It's kind of, it's you like give that gesture that, oh, you came there for that purpose. Mm-hmm. I think after I did that, and because it was just mentally, it's just like a huge burden. And I was coming off my last job where I was just working these insane work hours at like at the startup while doing bonsai on a weekend. At this at least good year period, I was just like just working out of my mind. There's no time off for anything. And so it was a long period of that plus preparing for that in Japan. And when I finished that, I realized like, oh shit, I'm like really tired. Yeah. definitely like burnt out like completely. And I was when I went to Japan, I was staying at my senpai's house with him and his family. And I think every day I just laid down, just didn't do anything. I was like, oh, I'm gonna go visit Seth or go to other nurseries. And I was like, oh man, I'm just gonna lie down.
So tired. Yeah.
I just lay down for like 10 days, just didn't do anything. I was super burned out. And I felt like, oh, I wasted my vacation time, but I just had to do that. Yeah.
It was a real vacation though. It was a mental break.
Yeah, it was a huge relief. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
But yeah, thanks for sharing that. That story seemed personal in a way. A lot of people are really straightforward about their experiences in Japan like that, you know, because
and definitely just, like I try not to like generalize or stereotypes anybody's experience, because definitely your apprenticeship experience is dependent on a lot of stuff, kind of that generation within the nursery. Because of course Japan bonsai in Japan dynamics can change over time, you know, people get older. I think it's probably a little different for every apprentice. And so I never try to assume for other apprentices, but there's could always be something. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's no way to prepare anyone for bonsai apprentices. Doesn't matter. Like you said, generationally even. It's just, it's always going to be different. So, for our listeners out there that are aspiring bonsai apprentices in Japan, this won't be a guide to
it's gonna be different for everybody. Mm-hmm. But I think the important things, if you want to go to Japan, is just have like the right kind of adjusted expectations and mindsets, at least within the culture and what the apprenticeship model is. Of course you can definitely prepare for that is within your scope of control, and those things you should do, right? And so definitely, some things you can account for.
I'm hearing more and more people that are pursuing apprenticeships are actually taking on Japanese as a language too, which I find to be interesting, but at the same time a kind of an obvious given. It's kind of like, why wouldn't they think of that in the first place? It should be no-brainer, right? So I think it's really interesting to hear that more and more people are taking that much more seriously. Like you said, like language is everything over there, as far as,
definitely can help. But you know, there have been and there are apprentices which just basically don't learn Japanese for the whole duration there. In some sense, at least within the scope of your work, and of course you'll kind of understand specific to bonsai what's being said. You know, you can be okay, you can survive there, but maybe long-term it's like, depends on your personality, I would say, right? Could be more or less stressful. And so you kind of have to decide for yourself, like, what you can handle, what your expectations are, and just prepare accordingly.
I can imagine, like, being told to do certain things. And like you said, like, using context clues or just kind of, like, assuming certain things. I feel like you could almost feel... I would feel almost alone.
That's
weird isolation.
Thing.
Yeah,
you'd be super. Even that was a very hard part for myself there. And so I say I think the romanticized aspect I had, I was like that sounded exciting in my mind. I was like, I wanted to kind of integrate in their culture, right? And I'll have all these senior apprentices or mentors I learned from and whatnot. And you know, when I went there, it's like, In short time, I became the only apprentice there. There's nobody to talk to. You know, there's a phase where I think it's just my boss had stuff going on as well, and he just was almost never at the nursery. Like, so it's just myself, and that was also kind of stressful because I had to be responsible for that, talk to visitors and customers coming in, and then so it was just me for a while. And then when apprentices came in, it was Kaya and Michael. I think Michael speaks Japanese pretty well now, and probably Kai speaks some also. But at the time, it was like we were like all foreigners in the nursery and like super isolated, and there is like no chance to engage with like, say, just like normal people or just within and out of Banzai there. And so it's kind of, in some sense, you're really living in a bubble. And because I'm in that bubble, it becomes even harder to interact with people outside of that and, say, just have normal like conversations in Japanese. And so I just felt like really isolated, because I was thinking like, oh, I'm going to have people to talk to, assimilate in that culture. And it was, in a sense, I was kind of forcibly put in this bubble that I worked within there. That was just the given environment. And so it was just kind of weird. It's like you're a foreigner working in Japan, but in a space defined by people from other countries. And then you feel extra isolated. And that was hard for me. Mm-hmm. I had a hard time.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that being real tricky.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, because I think my experience is similar. Obviously, I wasn't apprenticing, but as far as being just thrown out in this feeling like, okay, got to make this work. How does Bonsai work for me? Yeah. Kind of feeling like that. It's an interesting way to hear that's how it kind of went for you over there. Especially maintaining customers and stuff. Cause I don't know if it's very common for a lot of Japanese nurseries to have, like you said, cause there was a lot of brokering through your
nursery.
Yeah,
it depends
on
the kind of nursery and basically how they're getting their income source. I mean, it could be like both, or they're like favored on one end towards another. So it just depends on the nursery.
Mm-hmm. And these customers would come in expecting to buy expensive trees. And also, like in Japan, the prices on bonsai is drastically different to what we're used to here. So
it's funny you mentioned the pricing, because I think about pricing in the U.S. and I think it has like no basis. It's completely arbitrary because like where our like on average like general practitioner understanding of bonsai is, and especially we don't have easy access to like old trees or what is like a good refined tree look like. You know, people self-impose their ideas on bonsai. So I think I like joke about this with Seth, but there's like that, I can't remember what it's called, but there's like that chart that's like your perceived knowledge versus your actual knowledge, or it's like a confidence versus a knowledge, right? This is the bell curve plateau thing, where it's people like are super confident in the beginning. They all think they're experts, but their knowledge is really low. That's kind of where our like pricing market is, where people will price things with the perception, or selling it as a perception, that I am offering you a refined tree or a mature tree or a complete quote unquote product. And then maybe if you're like a professional, you're like, oh no, this is just a project, because I have to like fix all this crap you did here, or maybe we have to grow a branch thicker. And there's just some time aspects you can't cheat. You can restyle something as many times as you want, but there are some fundamental core things that's just technique and time, and people don't understand that. And so typically the professionals, they see that, they're going to weigh more harshly against that. Like, oh, there's all these problems, you got to fix it. It makes it less valuable. And then maybe if you know less, you're like, oh, it's okay, it looks fine. And this is both good and bad. Like our market has tons of like semi-professionals, especially people who are brokering and flipping trees in the U.S. And they're all coming in with the mindset that like, I am offering the goods, right? These are the trees you want to buy. And it's very hard, because in that sense, the pricing becomes very diluted, and there's a less like quantifiable, like quality to cost association. And so the pricing is just like totally unstable, sometimes super high, super low. Like, whereas Japan is definitely and the funny thing, I remember after I was in Japan, you know, I was like, oh, I know tree pricing so well. Just show me any tree and I'll tell you per Japan pricing, right? Because in a broker nursery, so much throughput that you just start to like know at a point. And I remember my boss would buy a tree, and he would ask, I was like, oh, like, what do you think we should price it? And then you already know what he wants to price it. Damn, you just had that much exposure already. But definitely in the US, right, that's harder. The other interesting thing is, right, we have a lot of Yamadori in the US, like really good Yamadori, like Shinpaku's, right, in Japan. They can get, I say Asia in general, they actually sell for more money in the US. Like old junipers or trees that are just like physically in body age or are super old, just because there's less landmass in those countries, there's less of that kind of tree, they actually sell for more money in the US a lot of time. But say the grown trees and the cultivated trees or smaller trees, right, they tend to be cheaper in Japan compared to the US, where it's just there's just more more of them, right? Yeah.
It's a very timely topic because I've been having this conversation with a couple of different people over the last few days. And,
pricing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's totally it is messed up.
It's wild. You can go from
it's random.
Seeing one professional's prices, then going to the Bonsai Auctions page, then going to like other online sources. And it's like, what is even happening?
Yeah.
So it's, it's wild.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a fairly hot take, especially hearing it kind of like for what it is, you know, as far as pricing goes for bonsai. And I run a bonsai nursery where I'm at, and I know that, you know, from firsthand, like pricing trees is what I do, you know, with starting, especially raw propagation and stuff like that. And, you know, I know with the different aspects of these plants, like you're saying, there's age and there's things to consider for certain species. Like, you know, if you're growing a stock and then you, like for instance, a trident maple, and you chop it down and then you have to carve it in Japan, that usually wouldn't fly, right? You wouldn't chop a tree and then try to go with the wound. Whereas in North America, I mean, this is kind of what we have to do with a lot of the quick stock stuff that we do here. And it's like, what is this priced at? Because this is a whole entirely different market. And then we have to spend the time, you know, growing them and healing wounds and doing certain things with certain deciduous trees. And of course, the junipers here are a little bit different for me. So, you know, I have to really scout to find good junipers that weren't, you know, grown around here. You know, so... Yeah, it's really interesting to hear a first take from Japan market, especially you like you said, like yourself, like having firsthand dealt with the brokering and the understanding of pricing on that. So it's a hard pill to swallow, though, for all of us. So but I mean, things could get better. They could change, especially moving forward. I mean, I don't know what we would consider ourselves as far as the history of American bonsai right now, like what generation we're on. It's very hard for me to kind of.
Yeah.
That's negative five.
It's like a good
negative
question.
Five.
Because if we say purely by a time basis, when trees were first here is probably like World War II era, the earliest like Japanese American people on the West Coast. It was like pre-John Naka era. There were a lot of, especially like LA, California, like I think at the time Japanese only bonsai clubs, but it's just basically it existed in the US. And the problem that I've really like kind of seen this is that like in the US, like there is not as much of a generation to generation like continuity of trees. It's like each generation is like, I start up and do it myself. And then that's like very like American culture, where it's like, we're like individualistic. We show our own ability, kind of worth, talent and whatnot, and just very strong kind of do it yourself mindset. Where you don't see that like continuity of trees, but that's problematic for bonsai, because we know trees can exceed the lifespan of people, right? It's normal. And so what if our consideration was not to make the immediate best tree for ourselves within this time span, but purely concerned with the longevity and the best long-term potential of the tree, right? That mindset's different. And say if we adopted more of that, there'd be possibly, like, I don't know this, but like more continuity, or developing trees to get right, better and better. You know, like for example, and say like, you know, everybody has junipers, and so it's easy to talk about. Like when you develop, say, like junipers, and you build the branching, build the foliage. I mean, because junipers is just everywhere in bonsai, and people kind of see tree style, different shapes of trees, but people take it too literally, in that they think what the goal is to style a bonsai shaped tree, which I'm not saying that by means of natural versus not natural aesthetic, but they do more of a literal interpretation for whatever their aesthetic preference is. My goal is to create this shape. But like the kind of philosophy and principle of bonsai is not that. It's the aesthetic is an afterthought. It's a byproduct of the work, which is kind of imbued through time, what you produce. And so, you know, a lot of times, and right, even like professionals do this, and right, it's a common thing at clubs, because people, and this is a marketable thing as well, because people more care about that end product and that like throughput speed. Your goal starts becoming less of building the tree that is imbued with qualities of bonsai, which by effect also has a good aesthetic. It becomes a reverse approach, right? My goal is just to have this tree look a certain way. And and that seems like, oh, well, you know, what's wrong with that? You know, I want my tree to look nice. I make it nice faster. But it's kind of fundamentally wrong in that, you know, if you skip those middle steps and you just go straight to that end result without that like requisite technique and time, I will like straight up say like 90% of those trees get worse over time. I think like most professionals would agree with me. I have like no problem standing by that statement. And so then it becomes an issue where, say, you have a high number of trees in circulation where the immediate goal is like, okay, I'm just doing this for the aesthetic. You know, maybe in some sense it's good for the bonsai community. You're circulating a lot of trees, creating money for professionals, practitioners, but those trees kind of spend this time in stasis, like limbo. They float through the community through decades, right? And there is zero accretion of decades of work. And the hard part is we don't have trees like that to see as a reference. But say if we had trees where what is like a juniper look like that has a successful cultivated, and junipers is, this is harder, right? There's like a plateau point. It's hard to have branches with consecutive 50 years of work, probably in that time span. You're rebuilding, reworking stuff. So maybe the better analogy would be, say, for deciduous, right? So if you had deciduous trees with actual 50 years consecutive accrued work, right? Versus a trees which kind of stay in this stasis of, say, give or take 5 years of being kind of worked, maintained, redone. I mean, the effect is like night and day. But that's very hard to convey and tell people, because it's not like you can just go somewhere in person and be like, oh, let me go look at this nice comparison of trees to aspire and work towards. And so in that sense, like our bonsai generation market is young, that while it's existed, you know, for like, say like 80 years, maybe like 100 years, we don't have 100 years of continuity. It's kind of, it's like in my generation, I'm going to do it my way. And then maybe the trees die when I'm older. And then kind of you start over the next generation, right? It's hard.
See, this is where I see, and this is what I'm kind of excited about going back to working at the university, is this is where I see public collections becoming a useful tool in providing some of these trees for people to aspire to. But at the moment, I feel like a lot of public collections, the trees have been accrued, like they've gotten the trees from hobbyists, and then they aren't always hiring bonsai professionals to care for these collections. Right. So there's a lot of kind of the same kind of mediocre stuff just staying kind of mediocre. And so it's like, okay, how do we raise this level and create the best public collections we can? And there's some stuff in the works, which is super exciting you know, some public gardens and curators but it's like, I think there's a place for this, and absolutely to your point, like it's hard when you don't have a really good frame of reference, and everybody, it's like bonsai is a community sport, you know, like you have to take trees on from other people and continue to like work these trees over time and not always start fresh. And it's hard to do and it's hard to teach. And people just are so excited to have a bonsai. I mean, I was there. I think we've all been there. Yeah, you know, like, here's my bonsai.
Right.
But it's like, okay, really, you need another 50 years and then maybe you'll be getting somewhere.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Now, have you done any work for public? Sorry.
Oh, no, that's okay.
Have you done any work for public collections? I feel like I've seen you with some gardens.
Like three collections. Like, I mean, there's a Huntington Gardens close to me.
Right.
But I don't really do that much stuff with them. But sometimes it's a little bit kind of affiliated. Mainly like the Clark Collection in Fresno, which is another one of the California Golden State Bonsai Federation collections. Yes. And then I started... this year, basically for the Des Moines Botanical Garden out in Iowa.
Great.
Yeah, do some stuff for them.
Cool.
And so, yeah, some kind of trying. The hard part, I'll say, and this is, I think is important, these collections have good curators. And I've told this to, like, volunteers, you know. Yeah, I could do and say whatever, right? Maybe I could just be, like, bullshitting and be like, oh, like, do all this stuff. Tree's going to be great. That doesn't matter how good or not the work is if there's no continuity. And so what is more important is not paying like whatever skilled professional do this work, but that the people on site actually taking care of the trees is invested in that work. And because that's going to be way better than say you have like, say whatever, the best professional you can pay, but no good volunteers and care system versus the reverse. Those trees are going to be way better in the latter case. But I know, like, I know now personally, right? It's not very straightforward that, you know, you work with a public collection. It's first you're trying to make a case and arguing for, like, because ultimately it takes more money, right, to have more continuity of care. And so what is the case of argument you provide for them that having these trees elevated to the next level, what is that relevance to a public collection? And does that like increase in cost they have to invest in that, right? Does that upgrade the collection? Does that improve the standing or the public perception? And so it's like a tricky question because ultimately I think like, yes, you can make a case for that, but it's not very clear, right? It's not very simple. And so it helps if you have their organization, they're on board with you, right? And they support that, then I think it'll be much easier. But otherwise, it's very hard. And I agree in that, you know, public collections are really important. And they can create some perception of what bonsai could be. Of course, when you start out, you're just excited, like, oh, this is some cool tree in a pot. Like, maybe you don't really care about all those things yet. But I think just having it existing, you know, it puts something in your mind. And I'll say at least that like trees, which are very old as bonsai, they definitely have a presence, right? They have that, like there's like a physical, tangible thing to that. And people who don't even know bonsai, they see it and they just know like, whoa, like there's something, they don't know how to describe it, but they know something's going on. And so I think there is some like tangible value and but right, it's hard. It's not a straightforward thing to do. And, you know, I worry about that for the Golden State collections, because, you know, all these collections are, you know, volunteer run and, you know, by great, really dedicated volunteers, you know, but a lot of these volunteers and curators are 70 years plus in age, right? And so they kind of very selflessly dedicated, right, a lot of time to support these collections. And so it's a little like worrisome that, like, I don't know if there is a succeeding next generation who's just for the joy of doing that, it's going to dedicate that much time. And if not, then you're relying on the garden, the organization, to have enough money that they're willing to pay somebody to do that work, right? Which may or may not happen. So, yeah, I think a pretty iffy state for the public collections on California. I don't really know for certain, right, what that long-term trajectory is going to be.
My hope is that with so many people apprenticing now and coming back to the States and looking to get into professional bonsai, that more curatorships open up and people are interested and the gardens are willing to invest. And I think it's a long road. There's, I think, a lot of education for public garden administrators, you know, to get to that point. But fingers crossed that, you know, with so many more people getting into it, that we can continue to raise that level. So,
Cool.
Sorry.
Lots to unpack about. You know, these are a lot of things that we don't really deep dive into on the show too often, but it's very welcome because we don't get to see this side of, like you said, as far as I like just now with the curatorship type thing. It's just like, that's a lot to think about. It's like you said, as far as they have to pay for what it's worth, and is it worth that?
Right.
And that makes a huge impact on me hearing that part, because it makes me think about, you know, Louisiana or even Southeast. We just don't have that collection like that. It just doesn't exist, which is extremely unfortunate. And a lot of older trees are, like you said, they're just dying.
Totally happens. Yeah,
some of those great trees. And a lot of the trees that we've had here in the past, of course, have gone up to the National Collection, or I've seen quite a few of them actually hit the Pacific Bonsai Museum as well. And it makes you wonder how many other those other trees have been have made that journey outside of the Southeast. But it's a lot of food for thought to really sit there and think about that, you know. It's just a different world, you know, as far as how that works in the different garden spaces that bonsai would even be appropriate or survive in, depending on the interest. Any more thoughts about the curatorship's like a whole different episode.
Yeah, it could be like
we'll have to go on another rant another time.
It'd be a lot about that.
I feel like we covered a lot of bases there. That's really awesome. For Julian being really, really honest about your experiences in Japan, of course, and the current state of bonsai. I mean, like I said, it's different to think about how it translates over here to North American bonsai scene. I hope that someone hears this and takes it and runs with it to, like you said, create trees for not the moment, but for the longer, the bigger picture.
Yeah.
Because that's something I can't remember who else. Someone else told me this a while back. It might have just been Mike was ranting one time. Mike Lane was just saying, he's like, you know, you need the person who's taking the cuttings and twisting the cuttings and preparing them to become bonsai that he'll never see. And that's that brings that back to my mind again. It's people don't think like that here very often. It's a shame.
It's definitely a crazy concept, and it's not like I'm like, even for myself, or I'm telling people, it's like, oh, you must be like this like perfect selfless person or like the Buddha or whatever. There's some aspects where, you know, I understand, you know, you have to be selfless for yourself, or maybe it's more fundamental, just like your survival, and that's totally reasonable, right? That's normal. But I think as long as you can accommodate yourself in that baseline, then there's probably in different capacities for each person, right? Some aspect where you quote unquote like give back, because bonsai just has that continuity like that, and if we don't really consider that, it's has a hard time, right, to progress in the long run. And maybe that's like some missed potential. And because I'm definitely like saying, like, my personal trees, I was trying to think, the oldest bonsai I have, not like physically old, but the oldest as a bonsai, and it's like this oak tree. I think I posted photos of it. It's like in this yellow pot, and I'm pretty sure I'm like the first owner, fourth owner. The previous owner was this hobbyist in Sacramento, Bob Bouguet, that I met when I was going up to Peter T's place, and it's like this super cheerful older guy, just always happy and smiling. And then he gave me like a great deal on that tree. And then just because at then he kind of like knew me, and so we're kind of acquainted. And you know, and he just like suddenly passed away out of nowhere like last year. And I think if I look at the tree, and of course I think of him, and then right, he's like a great person, very nice person. And I was like, there's no way I could make this tree myself, right? It's like mm-hmm. a lifetime kind of thing, like even if. And mm-hmm. and so it's more like, it's like not my right. It's like I have a privilege to be able to have an old tree. And I think there's like something about that, that, you know, we can appreciate more this kind of like time aspect. Yeah, Yamadori is a whole nother thing, right? It's kind of like mm-hmm. a cheat code. You like take the age from nature. But it's different in the sense where it's not just the tree being physically old, but like that cultivated age. How long has people worked on it? And just having that, right, is definitely something kind of like special or magic about that. And I can't remember what was the point of like, what were we talking about?
No, it's okay.
Yeah, losing my train of thought. Yeah,
no, it's all right. That's what we do on the show here, is we just kind of, we get to a point where we get confused and we circle back and then we keep talking. So,
yeah,
but no, I'm looking at the tree. So if you guys, for our listeners, go over to BONTSAI_bonsai, on Instagram, and like he said, like Julian said, he's got this oak in a yellow pot. I really appreciate the flip-flop tan line that you to show off here.
Spice things up, you know, increase my viewership on my Instagram.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a bonsai trap, so be careful. This, like you said, this is an old tree, and you can see it, like the age of the trunk, you know, when you see old branches with bark on them that have been there, like you said, for a long time, for someone who really, really cared about this tree and wanted it to look a certain way. It's just these types of trees. You come across these trees, it's like, oh, this is 30, 40 years old from a seed. That's very, very special. You know, this tree looks like it may have been from seed.
And, you know, I only vaguely, and this is kind of like, I guess it's too late now, but I should have really asked Bob more on the history, because gave me like a brief kind of history. Yeah. But it was collected originally, probably from like one of those like Japanese hobbyists or practitioners on the Central Coast or Northern California. And then it was sold to somebody, and who, this is just like lost history at this point. And then I think Bob got it as a third owner in like the late 80s or 90s. And I have those pictures, like basically 30 years ago, that tree.
Yeah, that's
and
then awesome.
The key thing is, it was in a pot that whole time since being collected. So it's been like somebody's been watering this in a pot for like 50 years. And so I really think about that. I was like, oh man, a lot of time spent watering, and then I start to like really appreciate that. I was like, these trees are beyond my scope, right? I couldn't make something like that on my own.
Yeah.
So definitely, yeah, something. And then I feel that's such a core part of bonsai, where, you know, it's like you have to incorporate time, right? And that's integrated with the work, and it's an aspect you appreciate. Like a tree without that consideration it's like a soulless tree, right? Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, and it's actually, I hate trees which have been worked with no consideration for that, because it's just very like brute force and not elegance. And mm-hmm. I was like, need to think about the time and that are the great trees, right?
This is a good little snippet here of, you know, me and Carmen have had this debate a while back. Mm-hmm. You remember Carmen, what I'm alluding to, as far as
I know what you're talking about.
If someone did work on the tree in the past, it's like, if it was wrong, how wrong is it? If you could still refine it and restore that image, but make it better based off of that design. And it's like you said, Julian, it's like, it would be a shame for someone to go in and want to, you know, quote unquote, fix major flaws or anything. Like what do you do in that situation? You know, that's a debate, you know?
Yeah. So I like a rational way of like looking at that, but say like, if you're, and it is very common, right? So you buy like mm-hmm. old deciduous trees, but maybe the knowledge and technique to build the branching like 40 years ago when it was, you know, is your opportunity to really get it going well, was like not quite there. And so you have fundamental problems rooted way deep in the branching. And something people don't think about when, you know, this is just in bonsai in general, actually not just deciduous, you always have to consider the balance of the tree. And so it's very difficult to selectively be like, oh, this one branch sucks, I'm going to cut it out and rebuild it. It's not like the rest of the tree grows into stasis, right? It's still growing. So you have to consider that strength dynamic. You just made one part a lot weaker and the other parts are stronger. So a lot of times, say if you're forced to redo some fundamental structural flaw, it's like you have to start over, which is common like in deciduous. And so say you're entertaining to do that, you have to kind of ask yourself, how much better is this tree going to get to lose the given accrued age in it, right? Or the reverse question is like, how messed up is the, but maybe aesthetically in the balance is just so screwed up, it doesn't matter, it's old, it just looks terrible. And and it's like an easy decision. But usually it's not so obvious, there's some give and take. Say like the quality of the tree only gets, this is just arbitrary, but like 20% better. And I have to redo like 15, 20 years of work to make it 20% better. Is that 20% increase of quality worth that loss of 15 years of accrued age in the branching? You know, probably not. But if it's like the tree is like double the tree, three times the tree in terms of its balance, presentation, quality, form, then you have an argument that for the given age so far, it's not enough to make that justification. A kind of a funny thing, and I don't even remember who told me this at this point, it was probably like my senpai in Japan. But, and they said, and this is kind of a saying in Japan for old trees, they say when something gets old enough, you just forgive it, right? It's kind of like alluding to people, where like, you're not going to like, go say like, whatever you have I'm just like making this up. I'm not like referring anything. Let's say you just have some extended relatives in like a nursing home, and maybe they're just like mentally really screwed up and maybe you hate them for some reason. You know, at that point in their life, say that you're in like your 70s, 80s, 90s, it's like you're not going to go to somebody that age and be like, you have to change everything about yourself. Your existence is wrong. Right? It's kind of like at that point, what has happened, you give a concession and you live your life best you can. And it's similar like in trees, which at some point, if it's so well settled in that kind of like, you know, age or form, it's kind of disrespectful to the tree. You can't just be like, well, screw you, I'm going to deny your past, become this. Like, hard to do that at a certain point. And so there's definitely a rational approach where you just have to, you have to just kind of discern like, what I'm obtaining and what is that cost, right? Because there's that kind of like, whatever, what is that? Like the zero sum fallacy, I don't even know what it's called, where it's like you don't make that next step because you're ready to invest it or something. There's some kind of like saying like that, and which may or may not be true. So you have to just kind of discern for that given situation, right? Like, is it worth it, basically? And sometimes yes, right? Saying the case, and this is common, say for like demo trees or clients who work with multiple professionals, you know, I don't have such a strong view on a tree where I see another professional's work. Like, my thought is like screw that professional, I don't like it. And you know, that happens in the bonsai world. If you want to like piss off other professionals, what you do is you redo their client trees, right? It happens all the time, right? So I'm not going to say any more than that, but I like experienced that, right? And so, and so normally say, you know, if I'm working with a client or whomever, who a tree has touched multiple hands, it's like you really need to give it consideration for what purpose am I changing this, right? Or can you integrate something with the given design to keep on progressing it, right? You don't want to constantly reset this calendar of development on the tree. It's just pointless, which is, you know, that even happens, say, in our old Golden State Bonsai conventions. Sometimes they recycle the same tree for the demonstrators. Like, oh, we'll just keep giving it to professionals, right? And I'll just straight up say those trees look like shit, right? It's terrible. And and it's kind of like you have to think, like, what is the work I'm doing now? How does it impact the future? And how do you continue that, right? And if you are changing and deviating it, is it like some adjustments, which is fine? Is it a complete restructure and rebuilding, which is maybe still okay if you can have good utilization of the branching? But the important thing is you give it that respect and consideration. And so you just don't want to brute force things, right? Because I see that a lot where, you know, people, the depth of their thought process is very like surface level. And they're just like, I do this because I can, or because I believe I'm great. And so it's like this, you forcibly impose your ego on the tree, and the tree has no choice. And trees like that tend not to look good long term, right? It's kind of, you need to work considerately, and then the trees will be more elegant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that was a great way to put that.
Yeah. The long form, concise way to say that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's like, we have an old tree with flaws. What do we do? And then Julian's like, I got this. nice long explanation. But it's all things that, you know, yeah. I definitely see where it's coming from with that for sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, let's go ahead and start getting towards the end here. I do want to go ahead and mention Save Bonsai. So Julian, in case, you know, our listeners weren't aware, that you will be one of our headliners at Save Bonsai 2025. And we're pretty much announcing that, you know, we announced that this past week, and it's going to start circulating a little bit more and more as, you know, social media catches up, because we have to make flyers and reels on Instagram and Facebook and all that stuff. But this will be kind of the first time that people will be hearing it over the show. And we have a good bit of listeners in the American South and then Midwest. And then I think we have a handful of people on the West Coast. I'm not sure. But as far as what...
Oh, we got people over here listening.
Okay. The analytics tell me stuff. I don't know. I don't, you know, because a lot of people come up to me down here where I'm at, and they say, oh, well, we listen to your show and stuff. So, but yeah, people are going to hear it for the first time. That a lot of people in the American South here are going to hear you for the first time. And so I'm sure they'll be excited to meet you. And it's kind of interesting to say, you know, we had Julian on, and he'll be here with us in March, March 28th to the 30th. To basically, you know, work on trees with us, demo on trees, do workshops with trees with people, so people can have a really special experience with you. So if you guys are looking forward to that, y'all can go check out the website underhillbonsaistore.com as soon as we get those tickets going. We're just now ironing out the itinerary, so we kind of know what everyone's going to be doing on each day. And we're also getting our hands on workshop material. We're making sure we can get the best we can, given, you know, the talent that we're going to be getting this year at Save Bonsai. So Julian, alongside Sylvia Smith as well from Dallas, Texas. And then, of course, we have the little things, me, Mike, and Carmen. And then we have our local experts, Randy Bennett, Dawn Ketting, and of course, Guy Guidry. Can't go without mentioning Guy, because, you know, he's kind of our guy down here. He's our guy. Yeah, he's, you know, we had him last year, but we're glad to have Guy back each year. But yeah, as far as say Bonsai, just really quick, Julian, are you looking forward to anything coming down to Louisiana? Are you anything in particular? Not just Bonsai, but cuisines or anything, or what you looking for?
Yeah, so, you know, I've never been to Louisiana or like much of like South, Southeast. And you know, so really I don't know too much in terms of like not only the local bonsai culture, but just like the area. And so it'll be like pretty fun to see another part of the US and kind of see what's going on, like food and people wise. And I enjoy that aspect of like work traveling. I visit places probably I wouldn't go normally. Not that there's anything wrong with the places I'm going to, but it's like I don't have friends or family there or something I'm specifically seeking out. And so it's definitely great to get that like broader exposure and right, see people from other parts of the US. So I mean, just excited for that in general. I couldn't say specifically because, just to be honest, I don't know that much about Louisiana.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a whole new thing for me.
We're kind of throwing you straight in it, to be honest, as far as we do crawfish boils that time of year, and I made sure that that was a huge part of the show. And so I know when we brought on Sergio Kwan last time, not the last time, but the year before that, and doing boiled crawfish with him, and him expressing he's like, this is really something else. So and for Carmen, it'll be your first time doing Louisiana crawfish boil.
Yes, I've been to a crawfish boil, but it was not in Louisiana.
You,
So
but not
it's so it wasn't a Louisiana.
I will
So
not accept a crawfish boil outside of Louisiana.
okay, so no, I have not.
Yeah.
I mean, you can. Okay, for our Texas listeners, I'm sorry. You guys boil y'all's crawfish in y'all's own way. There's nothing wrong with it, but yeah, Louisiana crawfish is way different. But anyway, but yeah, I'll make sure to try to get you down to New Orleans as well. You know, it's always
Oh, cool. Yeah,
an interesting thing to
be cool
see.
to see.
Yeah. But other than that, I mean, it's all swamps and stuff. It's pretty wet here. So if you're into that kind of stuff, there's that to see as well. But yeah, we'll make sure we'll treat you really well down here. Like I said, if you guys like what y'all heard in this episode and y'all want to work with Julian, he'll be over at, say, Boneside 2025. But we really appreciate you hanging out today, man. That's
Oh, yeah.
Awesome.
Thanks for coming
Thank you
on.
for hosting me. It's great to talk with you guys. And yeah, always fun to chat about bonsai.
Yeah, and that's what we're here for. It's quite literally the passion of what we talk about here, and the show is exclusively just about that. So it's awesome to you know, especially I just want to go ahead and, you know, put this out there too, especially for young professionals, people that we're getting to see actually start traveling. We're seeing new faces on the circuit. It's just exciting. I feel like we're on that next wave of you know, people who are going to be teaching, people who we should expect to see for quite some time. So we would like to thank you in that part too as well, Julian.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yeah, for sure. So yeah, like I said at the beginning of the show, we always shout out our patrons' names, that all the people that sponsor us, how thankful we are. So I'll go ahead and go through that list real quick with Wallace Woods Pottery, Bonsai Samurai, Radtron Studio, Kyle Ford, I always mess the name up. It's just the thing I do. Wesley Thompson, Joseph Dominguez, David Smith, Eddie Fernandez, Byron Myrick Pottery, Chantel Wynn, Hist Warrior, sorry, Christina Carforia, David J. Boccaccini, Gilbert Jorez, Sean Seaman, Various Bonsai, J.M. Stewart Woodworking, Joshua Roth Limited, Nancy Hoffman, Nate Murray, Ben Crean, Victrina Ridgeway, Timothy Arsenal, Chris Fassoon, JSA Potts this time. That's what you get an extra A in there. Bonsai Marine, AC Castle, Luis Torres, Karen Codswell. Man, I'm doing great today. Austin Adkins, David N., Chase, Taylor Peacock, Greenwich Gardens, Backyard Australia, Bonsai. God. Dang,
Backyard
man.
Bonsai, Australia.
Thank
There
you,
you go.
Carmen. You
You're
recovered that
welcome.
one. They almost just dropped us. Justin Knight, Joel Jenkins, Ryan Gardando, Stabby
Gardano.
Chappers, Joshua Bentley, Ricky Ruins, Boyd Snellgrove, Vicky Off, Montana Bridgman. And then, of course, our specimen best buds on Ryu N. Bonsai Garden in Australia, and Bill Butler of Bill's Bayou, the anchor specimen best bud of the group. So thank you guys so much for sponsoring. I don't know why today was exceptional for me as far as speaking
You have a
English.
baby, just say you were tired.
That too. That has been a little bit of a thing. So, but the sleep is getting better. My
Don't
wife
worry,
would
it'll get worse
say
again.
otherwise. Yeah, exactly. Say otherwise.
You're welcome.
I sleep a bit like a baby while she stays up and feeds the baby on, you know, and it just happens. It's part of it. But yeah, also like you said, Carmen, the regression's coming. So
Oh, yeah.
yep. Yeah. She's just like, oh, he's in for it. I can't wait. But
I'm
no,
not very helpful, am I?
no, I'm not. No. We had a Bonsai Parent episode. We did that. We talked about it. I know where I'm at currently, so it'll be
It's
fine.
coming.
Yeah, I'll be fine.
You'll be
But anyway,
fine.
so Jillian, tell people where they can find your content, or if they want to find any way to contact you to work with you. Is there anywhere they can check you out?
Yeah, I have a website. It's just bonsai.com, including the just, right? So J-U-S-T, bonsai, B-O-N-S-A-I.com. I also am on Instagram, which is bonsai, B-O-N-T-S-A-I underscore. And I'm on Facebook as well. And I think my Facebook is just linked on both of those website and my accounts. So it's just easy to find from there. But usually I'm like pretty like semi-regularly posting work, infrequently writing on my blog now. But I'm accessible on any of these. And so you can reach out and email me and we can talk.
Yeah, for sure. And then for Underhill Bonsai, you can go to underhillbonsai.com, see some articles that I've written, go over to our YouTube channel, see some videos that I've made. And then, of course, you can go to underhillbonsaistore.com and you can buy some little things for bonsai people merch. You can see what trees we're offering on the website from our nursery. And then we have Instagram and Facebook on that. And then for Carmen, where do they check out your stuff?
You can find me on Instagram and Facebook at Becoming Bonsai, and be sure to check out the Purple Pot Society, the national women's bonsai group that works to encourage and inspire women to do bonsai.
Yeah. You don't have to be a man to, I mean, you don't have to be a female. You can be a man to support
you
women
can be
in
a
bonsai.
Man.
To
yes.
be a, yeah. to, yeah, to be a member of the Purple Pot Society is where I was going. You, yeah.
Yes.
So anyway, you guys have a great week. Thank you guys for listening to Little Things, and we will catch up with you guys on the next one.
Great. Thank you.
See ya.